All right. So, Noach. What I wanted to talk about, you see at the top of the page, the extent of empathy. And specifically, there's this big thing going on in the middle of the parasha that we just sort of ignore. We focus all on Noach and Noach's family and how they're so wonderful. At least Noach is wonderful, and Naamah presumably is wonderful, and therefore they're saved while everything else is destroyed. But the fact that everybody is dying is not, like, you can't just skip that part of the parsha, that the world is just gone. And I thought this was captured really well in source number one, which comes from a mommy blog. I took one at random. There were a lot of them that I could have picked on. But just, it really bothered me, like when my kids were little, that you had these children's books with pictures of Noah's Ark, and you had the liner for the crib with the pictures of all the animals, and you had the stuffed things. Like, this is not a good story. Like, at some point, the kid has to learn that those are the ones who made it, the ones on the boat. If you take a look at what I brought you here, she writes, "I don't care if you're Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, or worship the ways of the Jedi, I'm sure you've heard of Noah's Ark. It's the biblical story where God tells Noah there's going to be a huge flood that instructs him to build a huge ark so he can save his family and two of each animal on earth." Yes, that's not quite accurate. It's seven of some of them, seven couples, two couples. It's a pretty popular tale, and I have a huge problem with that. Let me explain. Back in the day when I was birthing babies, the Noah's Ark theme was a huge nursery room favorite. It still is. A wealth of Noah's Ark products are out there for purchase, crib bedding, lamps, pillows, pictures, all featuring cute little animals walking two by two into the ark. As for books, holy smoke, there are dozens, all aimed at the younger set. There are a bunch of toys too. Even Fisher-Price makes an adorable play set complete with Noah, the Ark, and animals that I did not know. So what's my problem? The fact that Noah's Ark is one of the most horrific stories in the Bible, all caps. God condemns everyone. There's a huge flood. A fraction of life survives while everyone else drowns. This is the stuff bedtime stories are made of. This is the story we push on our children. And, you know, I mean, she's right. Like, this is a problem, this story. And in fact, what we're going to see is that halacha expects us to have empathy and to display it in really concrete ways, even for this generation of the mabul. It really shouldn't be a source of kids' toys, which is not, you know, now I'm not saying throw out all the stuff, you know, two by two pairs and whatever, but I'm basing this on a medrash, which I gave a longer shiur on. I think, Alina, you might have been there, in source number two. So that's a link for those who want to get really into the text study piece of it and what the Medrash is building on. But we'll see the Medrash, and that's going to be the springboard for this. So who goes into the Teva? What's the population of the boat? Besides the animals, I'm not talking about the animals. Human population.
All family. Wife, right. Sons, and daughter-in-laws. Yeah.
Right. You have
and daughter.
Right. Well, no. You have Noah. His wife is Naamah. We're taught Shem, Ham, and Yafes, and their wives, who seem to be anonymous. That's the population. There's some discussion about Canaan potentially having been born on the boat. Right. Ham's son, Canaan. Who gets involved in that other difficult story with Noah after the flood. But that's your population. Take a look at source number three, where it describes them entering the boat. And tell me what's strange about this pasuk. Actually, it's not describing the entry, sorry. It's describing that they will enter. Vakimosias brisi itach. Hashem says, I establish, I uphold my covenant with you. Uvasa el hateva, you're going to come to the boat. Ata uvanecha v'ishtecha unishevanecha itach. You, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. What's odd?
Just say family.
Okay.
Why is he splitting the wife and the sons?
Right. We break it down by gender. Right? Isn't that a strange thing to do? Right? Why is it that we're splitting up the genders there? Now, the truth of the matter is, if you look at number four, you find when we went down to Mitzrayim, we distinguish by gender. Vayavo Mitzrayim Yaakov v'cholzaro ito banav b'nei v'nav ito b'nosav u'b'nos banav v'cholzaro. So there it says, they came down to Mitzrayim, right? Yaakov and his children, And it specifies sons, grandsons, daughters, granddaughters. And then sort of summary, all of his children. But there it doesn't actually mention the wives. So it just says sons and grandsons, daughters, granddaughters.
Doesn't it have to do with like procreation?
Meaning?
Meaning that like God is destroying humanity, but he's like saving enough with each gender that it's not like the end of...
So you're emphasizing by splitting them.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it emphasize their survival more by putting them together? Right? Like when in creation, right, it's always Zachar Nekeva Bara Osam, Zachar Nekeva Bara Am. He created them male and female. Now you're doing Zachar, 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 Nekeva, Nekeva, Nekeva.
If they came out of the Teva and there were children, just so they know the reason why there was the Mabul and destruction, it wasn't with the mother, there were wives there as well that they came into the Teva. So like there's no inappropriate... I'm just thinking of it, what was happening with the world and the destruction.
Yeah.
So we're making it very clear that the wives and the sons were, everyone was there. They came to the Teva, and grandchildren that were born.
Yeah.
They might not have been with the mother.
Oh, you're saying that it's meant to
legitimize or just.
Interesting. But again, couldn't you have done that by listing the husbands and wives together? I don't see why listing them separately helps in that regard. And not only that, but the segregation is reiterated. Take a look at number 5. Here's where they actually enter the boat. Be'etzem ayom hazeh, on that very day, right, the whole medrash on why the Torah says on that very day, there are 4 times in the Chumash where something is described as happening on that very day. And the medrash says, it's each time it's Hashem saying, I'm going to make this happen and you can't stop me. It's happening in the middle of the day. There's one medrash that only has 3 of them, another one with 4, right? One of them is Avram's Bris Milah, which he does even though the world is going to think that what he's doing is strange. Another one is Moshe's death, that it happens also, you know, they can't stop the death of Moshe. The other one is when we leave Mitzrayim, I think. It also says, Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, Hashem takes us out of Egypt. So here, Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, the on that very day, Ban Noach, V'shem V'cham V'yefes B'nei Noach, so we list all of the males, and Eishes Noach, and Shloshes Neshe Banav, Noach's wife, and the wives of his sons. And then when they leave the boat, take a look at number 6. Seimen ha-teva, ata v'ishtecha uvanecha unishe vanecha yitach. This is really interesting. What happened?
They mix up when they're coming out.
When they leave the boat, they're listed together. The husbands and wives are listed together.
I thought Shem climbing out that they had no children before this. They're all married.
That's what it sounds like. It sounds like their children are only born afterwards, which creates the question about Canaan. That's the problem with Canaan, because he seems to be alive and well
and
afterwards, and old enough that he can... Yeah.
Who's the father of Canaan?
Ham. Right, so
and
that...
And Noah's born on the boat. Isn't that terrible? Why is it? What do you mean?
So it goes.
Yeah,
the in-laws don't make it. There are lessons to be learned here.
And not a family. Like I'm saying, none of the other...
Correct. But keep in mind, for Naama, right, her family is from Kayan. Right? That's sort of the side of the family that's not supposed to make it. Effectively, Naama is the representative of Kayan in humanity.
What was the population of the world then?
We have no way to know. I mean, we can, you know, play guessing games, but it doesn't, there's no, the Torah only tells us about the line from Adam and Chava down to Noach, and doesn't give us other than to say, Vayoled Banim Uvanot, right? They each had sons and daughters, so there were more people around, but it gives us no frame of reference at all for figuring out how many there were. There's no real reference point for that. So the Medrash, and I feel like you probably heard this at some point, says, if you're telling me that they're separated going in, but that when they leave the boat, they're actually together, the answer has to be that they were actually split on the boat. The husbands and wives are not inhabiting the same space on the boat. If you take a look at source number 7, this is the Medrash in Bereishis Rabba. My English translation goes over onto the next side for those who are following in the English. Ata uvanecha, the Torah says, you and your sons come into the boat. So Rabbi Yehuda bar Simon, Rabbi Chanan b'shem Rav Shmuel bar Rabbi Yitzchak Omar. We get a whole long list of sages who said the following. Noach kishenichnas l'teva nasar lo piri v'rivya. Procreation was prohibited for Noach, and by extension his family, when they entered the boat. So the opposite of saying it's in order to clarify, no, they're actually not supposed to be producing children. And so the text has the males entering independently and the females entering independently. And then when he left the boat, it was permitted for him, and they quote that last pasuk that we saw in number 6. It's really interesting because it is counterintuitive. I would have thought you're destroying all life, you want to start replenishing humanity. And what they're being told is, not on boat.
Because they have to take care of all those animals. How are they going to take care of newborn and all the animals?
So it's an issue of child care.
I'm really serious.
It's what you do on the boat. It's a full-time job. It's probably also just to prevent Giloy Arayot and things like that. I feel like.
Because they're in close quarters on the boat, so this way you just keep everybody separate.
I mean, it's
those are interesting.
So bad in their relationships. It's a basic thing, but like just this reflection of things were so bad.
So they need a reset.
Yeah,
I think these are all fascinating answers. These are all fascinating answers. The Medrash doesn't tell us why, right? The Medrash just says they're separated. We have to figure out why, and we're going to look at different ideas. But yeah, no, I just heard 3 new ideas. I hadn't thought about any of them. Child care. The father never thinks about the child care. Like, what do you mean? Of course they can do it. What's one more kid? What's that?
Lions and tigers and...
Oh, come on. They're the little baby things that you have on your on the crib. They'd be cute.
What do you think that it's inappropriate to celebrate life if Hashem's destroying the world.
Right.
Like when the Yarden split, we couldn't say hello, or there's something about the lack of...
Right, so what you're quoting, I wasn't going to go there with it because it's controversial, but it's an important controversy, so we will go there. The Yamsuf, right? The Torah describes the Jews going into the sea and the Egyptians behind them, and it says, "Velo karav ze el ze kol halayla," which literally just means this one didn't get near this one all night long, meaning the Egyptians didn't catch up to the Jews. However, the Medrash notes, "Lo karav ze el ze." Where does the phrase "ze el ze" ring a bell? The kara ze el ze, they are kadosh, kadosh, kadosh from Yeshaya. Where the malachim are described as singing to Hashem, and it's each one calling to the other ze el ze. And here it says velo karav ze el ze. So the Medrash says that the malachim are prevented from singing shira, and it describes how the malachim want to praise Hashem, and Hashem says, "Maaseh yadai tovim bayam," the work of my hands is drowning in the sea. "V'atem omrim shira," you're going to sing now. It's inappropriate for you to sing while this destruction is taking place. However, the flip side of it is that we sing Oz Yashir, and Hashem loves Oz Yashir. So, how do you square that? And so, the classic answer is the malachim weren't the ones who were in danger. They weren't the ones who had suffered under the Egyptians. They're not the ones who the Egyptians are chasing. So it's inappropriate for them to sing. We, on the other hand, were being saved from destruction. You better believe it's appropriate for us to sing at that point. So if you want to take that and apply that here, you can make the argument that it's inappropriate for Noah and his family to be procreating at this point while there's such devastation going on. And I would even go a step further with it. I didn't think about this before, but I think it fits, which is think of Lot's wife. Right? When they're leaving Sodom, don't look back. Why not look back? So one classic explanation is don't look back because it's a statement of I made it and I must be better than them. And no, you're not better than them. You're being saved because of your family. So you could look at it that way and say that it's inappropriate for them to be involved this way at this time. We're actually going to come back to that because that's going to tie into where this medrash is going to go. But I think there is an element here of don't engage in this. You know, it's inappropriate for you to be creating new life while this devastation is going on. Again, more to be said about that shortly, but it's a valid point. The only reason I say it's controversial is because of the question of, number one, we did sing, but also because it gets applied in a way that's problematic. They use that to describe the practice regarding Hallel on Sukkot, right? Meaning, on Pesach, we say Hallel, full Hallel, on the first day, right? Those outside of Israel, 2 days. And then the rest of Pesach, you say only half Hallel. Whereas on Sukkot, you're saying Hallel, full Hallel, the entire time. So some give the answer that this is because the Egyptians drowned, and therefore you can't really sing. The weakness with that answer is...
Why at all? Still singing.
Well, number one, you're still singing. But number two, when did the Egyptians drown?
Seventh
day of Pesach. Why'd you stop singing day two? It doesn't really fit. And so the more correct answer is probably the technical one, which is that on Sukkot, each day has its own karban. The karban is different each day, and therefore it's considered a new yantif, and therefore it has its own full halal each day, whereas on Pesach, it's the same karban daily, and therefore it doesn't warrant having this. There are other explanations also, but going back towards where we are here, yes, the issue of the contrast between what's happening on the boat and off the boat, I think, has to figure into this as well.
Why are we reversing the order, though? What was the answer when they leave the teva?
Because now they're permitted. Now they're allowed to each other. When they leave the boat, now they're permitted to each other again. So what we're saying
so what's the difference?
So now it says... where was it? Number six. You and your wife, your sons and their wives. We're uniting the families again. That's the idea. But we're not done with this medrash in number seven, because there's more to it. We read the first bullet point, in which we're told that they're split on the boat. But then Rabbi Avin quotes a pasuk in Eov. Amar Rabbi Avin. Ksiv. He quotes his pasuk from Eov, Bechoser ubekoven galmud, which is a very hard set of words, like much of Eov, to translate. Choser chisaron, I translate it as lacking. Kafan is a term usually associated with Aramaic for famine. Kafna, ra'av in Hebrew, kafna in Aramaic. And then galmud means alone. Okay, what does that have to do with anything? So he says on this pasuk, "Imra'isa chisaron bala olam." If you see that lacking comes to the world, the kafan of bala olam, there's famine in the world. Galmud, be alone. Heberoes ishcha ki ilu hi galmuda. You should see your wife as though she was galmuda. And he says that galmuda is synonymous in some places with nida. So the idea is that when there is suffering going on in the world, the couple should actually separate. And then finally, Rav Huna, or Rabbi Huna as he is in Bereishis Rabba here, gives you one more source for this. Uli Yosef yulad shnei banim b'term tavo shnas hara'av. Yosef has two sons. Remember that he's down there for the 7 good years, and then the famine begins. Before the years of famine come along, he has two sons. So Rabbi Huna picks up on that and says, that's really interesting. Why did you need to tell me when those kids were born? Right? Why didn't you say Yosef had two sons? And the answer is to emphasize that it's before the famine, not during a time of famine. So, thank you. What this medrash is doing is something that medrash does all the time, and people miss it, unfortunately, when they learn medrash. How many medrashim do you see here in number 7?
I feel like an odd day and age. It's like the opposite. Like when there's war in Israel, there's like a baby boom.
Yeah.
9 months later. Mm-hmm. And people feel inspired if the world is going in the wrong direction to have more children.
It's true. It's true. I mean, there's statistics on it. So there are three different midrashim here. This is a technical point, but it's a point worth noting. Medrash often gets published on a pasuk, and you just assume, well, this is all talking about the pasuk, but it's actually not. These are three different midrashim. There's a medrash on our text from the flood. There's a medrash from Eov analyzing the word galmud. And then there's a third medrash, which is talking about Yosef and his sons, and is just all published together because thematically it's associated. But the reason I stress this is, first of all, because it's good to know how medrash works, but also because it means don't strain your brain trying to figure out what the pasuk in Eov has to do with the flood. It's not claiming that there's any association, it's just that they have the same theme, the idea of separation in a time of trouble. So then the question is there anything that unites them besides the theme? And I think there actually is. The Medrash on Noach is really making a leap. If all I had to support the idea that people, you know, that spouses are going to be a part in a time of trouble, if all I had was that pasuk, I really didn't have to explain the pasuk that way, that they were separate on the boat. You could, you know, we came up with other suggestions for why they were listed the way they were. And frankly, it didn't have to be a message about separating during times of devastation. You had the child care answer. Right, it has nothing to do with separating during devastation. It's just, you know, a practical consideration. Maybe just don't, you know, want to bring extra food on the boat. Or you could give a completely different answer. You could say that they're separating like Moshe when he separates, right? Which is they want to get close to Hashem when they're on the boat. And so they say, you know what, we're going to spend whatever free time we have meditating, talking to God. We're not going to be engaged in other things. Once you throw in the Medrash on Eov, and you throw in the one about Yosef, now that tells me more, oh, there's a theme here. It actually is about separating in a time of devastation. And not only that, but Yosef adds, it's not only global devastation, but it's also when it's just something local. So that's this medrash. I want to do a little bit more on this medrash itself, even though it's a little bit technical, I think it's worth seeing, and then talk about this question of, so why are they splitting? And what is to be learned from it, and some of the applications of this.
Did Hashem actually command them? What were the commandments going into the Teva? Were there requirements, things you need to do, things you don't have to do, other than bringing the animals and taking care of them?
So at this point, they have their general six mitzvos, right? Meaning the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach are really six mitzvos that go back to Adam and Chava, and then the seventh one is when they come out of the boat, is about not eating from a live animal, because at this point they're actually vegetarian. They can't eat animals at all, which is a good idea when you're getting on this boat and you only have a limited population there. Someone gets hungry for a steak and suddenly the world doesn't have cows. That's all you have in terms of mitzvos, like don't worship idols, don't kill, don't steal. But according to this read of the Medrash, when the Pasuk says in number 3, you get on the boat, your sons get on the boat, your wives get on the boat, your sons' wives get on the boat, it's actually a unique mitzvah for that time only that they should be separated. That's the way that this medrash is looking at it. It's a specific mitzvah for that time. So I want to show you just a couple of important points that relate to the medrash, or interesting points that relate to the medrash. Take a look at source number 8. When they actually leave the boat, right? We said that when they get the instructions to leave the boat, they're listed together. Right? But what's the problem with that in number 8? Mm-hmm. Something happened. Right? Vayetzi Noach ubanav ishto nisheva navito. I don't understand. Noach left the boat separate again? I thought they were told that they can be together now. So the Chizkuni says it's just trying to show, look, it's in the order in which they entered, you know, it's just parallel language. But take a look at source number 9, where Medrash actually picks up on this and says, Vayitzei Noach, V'lo kibel alav lashuv et lishtol nisaseik b'piri yavarivya. He doesn't go back to Naama at that point. This is before Hashem has said, I'm not going to do this again. So they're not so sure that they should actually get back together. I thought that was interesting. And then another thing that's interesting, because I feel like you must have heard this at some point. How many Jews went down to Jews? How many members of Yaakov's family went down to Egypt?
70.
If you actually count them up, how many do you come up with?
71.
Nope. 69. You're one short. Why?
Wasn't she born?
That Yocheved was born between the walls, meaning that Levi's wife is pregnant at that point, and when they get into Mitzrayim, that's when Yocheved is born. So they actually arrive as 70, but she didn't descend to Egypt independently. She's in this, she's in utero at that point. That's a problem. Why is that a problem for what we've said?
Because it might look like Levi.
What does it look like?
Separate.
They didn't separate, right? They did not separate, and there was a famine going on. Mm-hmm. You've made this whole big deal, right? And Yosef didn't. You know, Yosef's sons were born before the famine, and they're separate on the boat. So, what happened? What went wrong? So Tosas asks that question in source number 10. He says, "Aser la'adam l'shamish mitaso b'shnei rabo." He's commenting on a Gemara that we haven't seen yet, so I'm going to hold off on the Gemara that he's quoting. But he asks the question, "Bim tomar, harei Yocheved nolda bein hachamot." Yocheved was born between the walls of Egypt. "V'osa ha'es es rav haya." That was a time of famine. "V'akarach shimshu mitosein b'shnei rabo." They must have done something during the years of famine. "V'yesh lomar de l'kulei amo lohavi aser el lemi sharotze linog aslo b'chasidus." So Tosfos answers that this isn't a law that people have to separate during a famine. It's a pious thing to do. Yosef observed it. Not everybody else. So that's a really hard answer to give. First of all, it's a hard answer because actually this is going to come up in Shulchan Aruch. It's going to sound like it is a law. That's number one. And number two, this is Levi you're talking about. So Rabbi Yael Sirkis, the Bach, did not like this answer at all. In number 11, he says, "How in the world could you tell me that Levi would have done that? I mean, the sons of Yaakov are wonderful. Yes, they sold their brother. Fine, you know, everyone's got something. But but in general, how could you think such a thing about Levi?" That's what he says in number 11. So his answer is that Levi and Yosef both did not have children yet at this stage, or had not fulfilled Puravu yet. Yosef has two sons, but there's a debate in the Gemara about how one fulfills procreation, but the basic psak that we have is that you need a son and a daughter in order to fulfill procreation. That's minimum for Puravu. So Yosef does not have daughters yet. Levi doesn't have kids. And so Levi says, "I'm going to prioritize the mitzvah despite this pious practice of staying away." Whereas Yosef says, it's still pious. Let me frame it the other way. The Isser, the prohibition, does not apply to people who have yet to fulfill Puravu. So therefore, Levi and Yosef are both exempt. Mm-hmm. Levi says, "I'm exempt. I want to go fulfill the mitzvah." Yosef says, "Not so fast. I'm going to stay apart anyway." That's the Bach's answer. There's more to be said. There's an article in the 12th volume of the journal Truman where he discusses this further. But I just wanted to note the issue so that when you get to Parshas Vayigash Vayechi and you learn about the family going down to Mitzrayim, people say Yocheved was born then. You can say, well, isn't that a problem? Doesn't we have a Gemara? But Tosfos resolves it. So now you have a nice Bar Torah. Okay. So what we've established at this point is the following. The Torah lists and Hashem commands the entry into the boat as separate. And the Medrash says, yes, they're actually supposed to be separate on the boat. We have floated certain ideas for why they are separate. What I want to do now is talk about three ideas that Chazal bring for why they are supposed to separate on the boat and how this affects us. Beyond this specific discussion about the boat and the couples and so forth, because I think it teaches us broader themes. One approach is to say Chana. Okay. One approach is to say what Chana said. The Medrash Tanchuma says it. Take a look at source number 12. Shebashar Shaolam Nitan Bitsara, at a time when the world is suffering, with Khurban and there's destruction. Asul Adam Li Zakek Bapiri of Arivia, that's just the wrong time for procreation. Shaloya Krishparhu Sik Bhurban Olam Vuhubone. Hashem is destroying, it's not a time for you to build. That's one approach. It's a philosophical statement. I think it's philosophical. I mean, I don't think it's practical, as a practical statement. Meaning, if you remember the story of Lamech and his wives, right? So Lamech's wives separate from him. So one read of that story is that they separated from him because they thought that that was going to be the end of the family line, which in fact it was, and therefore they said, why am I bothering to produce children? But I don't think that's a practical statement here. It sounds like it's a philosophical statement. However, this statement is problematic. To say, don't create at a time of destruction, Miriam already pointed out, the baby boom in Israel, the instinct is the opposite. But think also about one of the most famous stories in Medrash, in the beginning of Sefer Shmos, is the story of the birth of Moshe. And
all the boys,
they said exactly
the boys are being killed,
yep.
Right? And Miriam gets Amram and Yocheved to go back together, because that they should have children.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you could say, well, that's different. It's the Egyptians who are killing instead of Hashem's destruction. Yeah, you could give that argument. But I think there are more solid arguments we can use to explain this. And I think the main argument to bring is the argument of empathy. You can't separate yourself from the suffering that others are going through. You know, Hashem says, "Imo anochi b'tzara," I am with people when they suffer. That's a really, really important principle throughout Torah. Right, Moshe Weinberger makes this point beautifully, talking about a pasuk in Koheles. If you take a look at source number 13, the pasuk says, "Kimi asher yechubar el kol hachayim yesh bitachon," which you could translate as I did here, which is, for one who is joined to kol hachayim, to all who live, there is bitachon, there is hope. Meaning, if you are joined with other people, then you always have bitachon, you always have hope, you always have a future. Being joined with other people is hard, because other people aren't always the people you want to join with. Meaning, it means, this is Rabbi Weinberger's point, it means dealing with the nuances of other people, dealing with all their quirks, dealing with the ways in which they annoy you. Joining with other people means putting up with other people as they are, not demanding that they become like you. But if you're able to do that, then yesh bitachon, there is a future, there is hope. And Rabbi Rucham Levavitz, who was the mashkiach of the Mir Yeshiva 100, 120 years ago, makes this point beautifully in source number 14. He talks about the issue of nosei ba'olim chaveiro, which is mentioned in a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, of shouldering burdens with others. So he says, gadol kol kach inyan shel nosei ba'olim chaveiro. It is so important that people bear the burdens of others with them. B'mnei shezeh kol ha-Torah kula. He says, that's the whole Torah. Hainu ichud ha-nefashos lahargish zeh es zeh. Meaning, unification of people. I translated it as joining of souls. To feel what each other is feeling. That's what empathy is, right? Largish zezeh, for to feel what other people are feeling. V'chol limud ha-Torah, and he says, all of the Torah study, ha-limud v'hamaseh, all the Torah study, all the mitzvos, hine sof ha-matarashis achdu ha-nefashos. He says, the goal is from the neshamos to be joined. Lios margishim zeh et zeh, to feel what each other feels, shiyu echad mamash, to truly become one. He says, that's the goal of all of Judaism. You want to know what the Torah is for? It's to get people to feel empathy for each other.
So they know and found worthy and the right people, and they were worthy because they were so sensitive to what was going on.
Right.
So I think
Hashem is teaching that to them at this point. Exactly. That they can't say, Hashem saved us, we're the good guys, so we go on with life as usual. You can't live that way. And that leads us to the Gemara in Tanis in number 15, which is what Tosos was commenting on in the first place. Kol hamariv atzmo b'shnei ra'avon nitzal mimisa mishuna. Anyone who starves himself, makes himself hungry at a time of famine, will be saved from misa mishuna, which has become a Yiddishism, right? That's a Yiddish phrase, misa mishuna, but it's Hebrew. Saved from an unusual death. And he goes on to quote psukim there. I just didn't bring all the psukim that the Gemara brings. And Amar Reish Lakish, Reish Lakish says, Asur la'adam l'shamish mitaso b'shnei ra'avon. He says, relations are prohibited during a time of famine, and he quotes you the pasuk that we had from Yosef. And then you get the exception, chasuche banim, those who do not have children, in fact, are permitted. And then, tanura banan, we get one more lesson, bizman she yisrael shriyan bitzar, when the Jews are in pain, upiresh echad mehen, and one of them separates himself from the community. He says, I don't have to experience it. I'm okay. But in shnei malachei hashareis shemalavin lo la'adam, so two malachim who escort a person, we have this idea elsewhere that malachim escort people. Shabbos is the classic one, right? Umanichin lo yidein al rosho, they put their hands on his head. Va'omrim, and they say, ploni zeh shepirish min hatzibur al yireh b'nei chamas tzibur. If he's going to separate from the community, then he's not going to merit to see when they are ultimately comforted. So that's the message here, which Rashi underscores by saying in number 16, did Sarah Adam Leno Tsar Ba'atzmo. You have to feel the pain personally as well. But what's really striking in this is not just the demand for empathy, but even though the people outside that boat are awful, meaning the people are not outside the boat by accident. Right? Hashem's judgment is human beings have become so selfish, so destructive, so abusive of others. It's not just that these people are people who are worshipping idols where you would say, well, maybe they have some redeeming feature in terms of their relationship with other people. It's just the opposite. Hashem says my reason for destroying them is what they're doing to other people. These are the anti-empathy people, right? These are the people who, when you read the description at the end of Parshas Bereishis, the men are kidnapping women. They're stealing from each other, right? And not only are they stealing, but you know the classic definition of Hamas, mm-hmm. right, as is used there, is that they're stealing less than a pruta's worth from each other, right? Less than the most minimal coin. What does that mean when you steal something that's less than the most minimal coin? Why is that worse than other forms of theft?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, no, I've mentioned this point before.
You don't even gain anything.
It's not about the thrill,
but for the evil of the act.
It's for the evil of the act and to destroy the other, because everybody is going to steal less than a pruta's worth from this person. He's going to be devastated. They get nothing out of it.
Right.
They didn't gain anything. It's just to destroy the other. So the people outside of the boat are the last people I would think to be empathetic for. But maybe that's the point. That's why you need this, in order to establish that that's not the way the world functions. You need to correct their wrong.
And especially if they're going to be starting from fresh, you need that nida.
Mm-hmm.
When you procreate, you have to have that instilled
right.
in them in order to establish.
So adopt this behavior.
Exactly. So you don't right. repeat what's happening.
Right. Good. I brought you a number 17. It's really 17, 18, 19. I feel bad because Alina heard this already in my Yeshaya share on Tuesdays at Shrek Shemayim. But nonetheless, Yeshaya, there's a section in Yeshaya in which he talks about what's going to befall the nations of the region. And one of the predictions about the fall of Moab. But in that Nevuah, in that prophecy about Moab, in number 17, he says, Libi leMoav yizak. My heart cries out for Moab. Bricheha, Tzohar, those who flee, or refugees who run away, Tzohar, dot, dot, dot. And there's some debate as to how to read that line. Is Yeshaya really feeling bad for Moab? And so various commentators offer different ways to read it, but Rashi quotes you the Medrash in number 18, in which he says, Kol ha-Nevi'im hayu b'midas rachmim al Yisrael v'al obdei kochavim. All of the Nevi'im had mercy not only on the Jews, but also on the nations. And you get Yirmiyahu for Moab as well, and you get Yechezkel for Tzur. And the Medrash's point, it's a Medrash in Bamidbar Rabbah, is to contrast the Nevi'im that we had for us with Bilam. So Bilam wants to destroy us. Our Nevi'im are worried for them. And just as I looked at the clock and realized that because we started late, we're going to be short on time. So I'm just summarizing what you see in number 19. The bracha for the Haftorah. We say, Asher, in the beginning of the Haftorah, we say, bracha, and thank Hashem, Asher bachar b'nevi'im tovim, who chose good prophets. As opposed to, are there Nevi'im Rayim? Are there bad prophets? When God chose good prophets. So Rabbi Zev Wolf Turbovitz, in his Ziv Mishnah commentary on the Rambam's Laws of Davening, where the Rambam brings the this bracha, says yes, it means that they were merciful, compassionate, not only for Jews, but for everybody. So this is your second, and I think dominant, explanation for why people are supposed to split during a time of disaster. Although I like all the explanations about the boat, the child care, the arayos, and all of that, I think the idea of empathy is critical. And then the third idea I'll just mention briefly is you can't appear to indulge while other people are suffering because it will aggravate them. Now, in this case, on the boat, there is no them. But in general, as a matter of law, you can't show off to others your good fortune while they are suffering. And I brought you Rashi in source number 20, when the Yaakov says to his sons, go down to Egypt to get food. And he says to them, Lama Tisra'u. And so Rashi, bless you, says, Tisra'u means to display yourselves. And so the English I brought you there is on the Rashi. Lama taru atzmachem bifnei bnei Yishmael bnei Esav kilu atem sveim. Why are you not going to look for food? You act as though you're full. Bnei Yishmael bnei Esav are going to see you looking like you have stuff, because they did. They still had grain, hayolam tavua. But it's not right to show off that way. And this is actually brought as halacha. In number 21, I brought you the Shulchan Aruch, where it says it, that in fact, relations are prohibited during a famine other than for people who don't yet have children. There's a requirement for us to emulate Hashem, There's a requirement for us to have empathy for others. The emulation of Hashem goes back to what I had said before about Imo Anochi Bitzara, that Hashem is with those who are suffering. And then I brought you a quote from Rav Moshe Cordovero in his Tomer Devora, where he talks about the importance of emulating Hashem, how we are created to emulate God, and if we fail to do so, then effectively we turn our resemblance to God into a lie. That's the result. Okay. Now, I wanted to make sure to get to this, to hit the problem. Meaning, this is all really, you know, it's a nice cartoon. Okay? They split up on the boat, as seen in the Psukim, because they should empathize with the people outside the boat. And even though the people outside, I'm giving you a summary here for Friday night, even though the people outside the boat are horrible people who demonstrated the opposite of empathy, that may be the point, that you have to rebuild the world. And yes, when you're going to create this next generation, do it with empathy, and therefore separate from each other on the boat, aside from the other explanations for why they should separate on the boat. But here's the problem. Can you really live this way? Meaning, can you live this way now? Right? In a time when I can look online or I can turn on the radio and find out about famine everywhere. War going on everywhere. Are you really going to make this, you know, your way of life? How does a person function if they're going to do that? Especially when the Yerushalmi, which has brought us halacha in the Ramah, says it's not just about famine. It's anytime people are in pain. If there's war, if there's lacking in the world, you know, how do you live with that? This question always hits right before Rosh Hashanah also, when you get the flood of envelopes in the mail, and now it's the flood of emails as well. There's also some scam, which I don't know if you got it, but I certainly got email after email after email, I don't know how many dozens of them, where they put in the subject line something like, his wife died and he's taking care of 16 kids, or something like that. You know what I'm talking about? And you just get both parents were killed in a terror attack and the children are orphans. And it's a complete scam. which doesn't make you feel better when you delete an email with a subject line like that without reading it. Because, like, well, what if this is real? But fundamentally, how do you function if Judaism is going to demand this level of empathy? So I think it is important to know that there are halachic limitations to the responsibility. Number one is the Torah says, v'chai b'hem, you live by the mitzvos, right? And v'chei achicha imach, the life of your brother shall be with you, from which Rabbi Akiva draws that your existence comes first, meaning you have to make sure you can survive. That's number one. And it's not only that you can survive, but also that the way we function is we put those closest to us before those who are more distant. I brought you the Gemara in number 23 regarding tzedakah, where we are told, Shalchak kodem l'shalkol adam. Yours, those who are close to you, precede others. But there's one more point which I think is crucial here. And that's the last source that I brought on the sheet, and I credit Rabbi Weintraub, Rabbi Baruch, who was with us in the Kollel years ago, for pointing this out to me. The Torah has a mitzvah of helping out when you see somebody else's animal struggling, right? This mitzvah we call prika uti'ina. On the one hand, to unload the animal in the event that it's having trouble with the burden that's on it, or to help load it if there's trouble loading the animal. But the pasuk in presenting this, at one point the pasuk says, ki sir'eh, when you see, chamor sona'acha robeit tachad masa'o, when you see your enemy's donkey. And yes, there's an emphasis, the Gemara says, even though it's your enemy, you still help. And then on the other hand, it's ki sivga, when you encounter the other person's animal and so forth. So the Gemara says, kisir'eh, when you see, is different from kisivga, when you encounter. Seeing suggests even at a distance, right? I can see something from far away. Not as far away as I used to be able to, but still. The kisivga is when you encounter. It's right there. So, says the Gemara, kisir'eh, when you see, yachol afilu merachok, I might think my responsibility is even if they're far away. No, Torah says kisivga, when you encounter. Well, if it's kisivga, then maybe it's only pigiyamamash, the actual encounter. They have to be right in front of you for you to be obligated. No, the Torah says kisir'eh. Ve'izuhi re'iyash yeshba pigiyah, so what does that mean? Seeing, which is an encounter. So the Gemara gives you a distance, 7.5 mil. A mil is approximately a kilometer. But my point is not the specific measure they give here, but rather the obligation sets in with ri'ya sheyeshba pigia, when you see something and it affects you personally, and there is an encounter. If a person sees something that's going on and there's an encounter, they feel it, then yes, then they have a duty to act and to minimize their own. They have to reduce their own pleasure while someone is suffering. On the other hand, if it's not something that is an encounter, if it's not something that hits you personally, if you don't, if you don't feel anything from it, and not because you're a cold, terrible person, but just because that's way distant, then the obligation is reduced. You have to balance that, because you can't say, well, then I'm okay, I just won't have any empathy for anybody else, and it didn't hit me, so therefore I'm exempt. You can't do that. But it means you also don't have a duty to specifically go out there looking for suffering in order to make yourself miserable and say, well, I guess I shouldn't engage in anything pleasant. There's a balance that's going on. It's a hard balance.
Well, so as you said, like in the day of internet, if we see there's a famine in Africa, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to affect our life here right now.
So it's a yes and no. Because I also wouldn't want to be somebody who says, well, that doesn't affect me at all, right? It's a yes and type of a dialectic. It's neither view can dominate. You need to have a recognition of both. On the one hand, a recognition of this isn't me, and therefore I can live my life. But on the other hand, someone is suffering, and someone else is suffering, and therefore I do need, on some level, to ask, what does this demand of me? What is this? What does this expect of me? I wanted to just end that on a positive note, because this is like a downer of a sheer, like, okay, the world is dead, you know, the things in your crib are terrible, and you know, and so forth. They because I think that it's true. You need to have empathy for everybody, and empathy even for the rasha and for the wicked and so forth. But empathy doesn't always mean feeling terrible because other people feel terrible. It also means feeling happy when other people feel happy, right? Empathy isn't only about sharing in people's suffering, it's also sharing in people's simcha, right? We have this very important mitzvah being the Sameach Chasen V'Kala, right? People are getting married, you're supposed to celebrate and help make them happy. That's not just about make them happy so that they will feel happy. It's also for your own sake, to have a heart that embraces everybody. And yes, embraces everybody in their tzar, in their pain, but also embraces everybody in their simcha. So go looking for people who are happy and make sure that you can rejoice with them as well. Thank you.
Thank you.